Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. We are here tonight to discuss the future of Pershing Square. Tonight's panel discussion is part of an ongoing series in partnership with Red Cat's President's Forum, and I welcome our Red Cat partners here tonight. Steve is somewhere here in the audience. In January, CalArts President Steve Levine moderated a distinguished panel at Red Cat called Does Los Angeles Need a Downtown?, which discussed the symbolic importance of downtown Los Angeles and the role of public space in a privatizing world. We'll continue that discussion tonight with this wonderful panel, and we'll welcome your questions as part of the discussion. After the panel discussion, we'll open to you, and there will be a microphone circulating, so please wait until it comes to you because we do record for podcast. Moderating tonight's discussion and introducing our panelists is Christopher Hawthorne, who is architecture critic for the Los Angeles Times, where his informed and often provocative critiques play a vital role in generating public discussion about our city. In a recent interview, he commented, "Los Angeles is the most interesting city in the country right now because of what's happening with its urbanism more than its architecture. The city that became synonymous with sprawl has hit the limits of its growth and is turning back on itself, he explained. But it's not just getting denser, it's having to redefine itself as a city. This redefinition is affecting everything from mass transit and highways to planning, housing, and architecture. And part of the answer, he says, may lie in recapturing the city's past, and that's certainly something we can discuss tonight. Christopher's work has also appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, many other publications, and he is the author, with Alana Stang, of The Greenhouse, New Directions in Sustainable Architecture. So without further ado, Christopher, I turn it over to you, and please welcome our distinguished panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise, and thanks to Justin and everybody at Allowed. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's always fun to do the discussions here, and we really have a terrific panel whom I will introduce to you. Moving from your left to right, starting at my immediate left, is Lewis McAdams, poet, activist, and journalist. Lewis is the author of a dozen books and tapes of poetry, and his poems have appeared in many anthologies over the last 25 years. He has written on culture and ecology for Rolling Stone, LA Weekly, Men's Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and Los Angeles Magazine. In 1985, he founded Friends of the Los Angeles River, a 40-year artwork to bring the Los Angeles River back to life. And in the years since, Folar has become the river's most important and influential advocate. Next is Daniel Biederman, joining us from New York. Daniel is the co-founder of the Grand Central Partnership, the 34th Street Partnership, and Bryant Park Corporation, all based in New York City. He currently serves as president of the latter two organizations and as an advisor to downtown redevelopment management efforts in several other cities. Since the late 1990s, he has advised business improvement districts and designed the plan for new or improved parks in cities around the country. Next, Kathleen Bullard is the Los Angeles program manager for Tetra Tech. She's also an instructor in the UCLA Extension Landscape Architecture Program, where she teaches intermediate and advanced design studios in environmental analysis and planning. And that's important for our discussion this evening because this year's studios in that group have focused on analyzing and developing plans for parks in downtown Los Angeles, including rethinking and redesigning Pershing Square. She has a master's degree in landscape architecture and an MBA, and she has been a Loeb Fellow at Harvard. Next is Doug Sussman, the principal of Sussman Urban Design, which he founded in 1990. an award-winning urban designer and licensed architect. He has gained international recognition for his ideas and designs of urban public space. His clients range from public agencies and cultural institutions to think tanks, developers, and community groups in cities such as Hong Kong, Los Angeles, New Orleans, New York, Pittsburgh, and San Antonio. And his projects include master plans and detailed designs for regional transit systems, downtowns, cultural districts, civic and community centers, plazas, parks, and streetscapes. And finally, at your far right, Barry Sanders is joining us. He's a member of the Board of Recreation and Parks Commissioners. The president, is that right, Barry? Currently the president of that group and chairman of the Southern California Committee for the Olympic Games, where he led the effort to bid for the 2016 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. He also serves as executive counsel at Latham & Watkins, where he practiced law for more than 35 years and led its international practice group. He has served as co-chair of Rebuild LA and the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Walt Disney Concert Hall Corporation, and the Otis Art Institute. He's currently a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Pacific Council on International Policy, and the board of the Los Angeles Opera. So that is a sense of the really talented panel we have with us, who I think will bring to this discussion of Pershing Square a wide variety of perspectives, but also experiences from, importantly, from other cities and other models that may or may not apply as we think about the future of Pershing Square. Some very brief remarks by way of introduction. As Louise mentioned, this is the second of two connected panels on the future of downtown organized by Aloud and CalArts under the title of the Talking City series. And the first one, which took place a month ago at Red Cat, was designed to be wide-ranging and very much a kind of meta discussion and asked the perennial questions about whether we indeed need a downtown at all in Los Angeles. And this discussion tonight, this conversation, is meant to be entirely more focused and more specific and looking at the much-lamented problems with Pershing Square and the possibilities for its future. The slides, I should mention, that you see running behind me show Pershing Square at various moments in its history. And many of the more contemporary images are by photographer Gary Leonard, who we want to thank for his contributions with these images and more generally his photographs of downtown Los Angeles over the years. So as I mentioned, the idea tonight is to have a very specific conversation compared to the more wide-ranging one on the future of downtown in general, but still, as singular a topic and as singular a problem as Pershing Square is, I suspect we probably won't be able to resist the temptation to pull back out a little bit for a wider view, since I think in many ways Pershing Square is so emblematic of the kinds of planning obstacles we face in downtown Los Angeles and in this city. It is a piece of the public sphere that in many ways used to work quite well as a gathering spot and as a shared space, that we, if we didn't ruin it, we at least severely compromised it over the years by making a series of decisions that gave a lot of leeway to cars and to a parking garage at the expense of pedestrians, and I think at the expense of the free flow of people from the streets and sidewalk into the park and vice versa, from the park out into the street. And because of the group of panelists we've assembled tonight, I'm sure that the discussion will move in and out from the park to broader questions about the city and models, as I mentioned, from other places. And in that vein, let me say that we come together for this conversation at a time when the subject of park space and park design in downtown Los Angeles, despite the financial crisis, is, I think, very much top of agenda right now. The latest version of the Civic Park, which is connected to the Grand Avenue development downtown, designed by Mark Rios and Rios Clemente Hale, will be unveiled tomorrow. And I just finished this afternoon, actually, writing a piece, an assessment of the latest version of that design. So that subject is very much in the news. And also, there's a small park on Spring Street near 4th Street that the city of Los Angeles purchased not long ago. The first purchase that the city has made of parkland was so-called Quimby funds, which had been very controversial. So there is certainly movement and development on this topic, and whenever there's movement on this topic, it's never long before we turn collectively to a discussion of what to do with Pershing Square. All of us, I think, have been talking and thinking a lot lately also about the recession offering a chance to catch our collective breath and begin to more carefully plan the shared spaces of the city. And certainly with the delay in or the possible demise of the Park Fifth project on one side of Pershing Square, which promised to help fund some improvements to Pershing Square, we're faced with a chance to take that breath and do some of that planning now. And I think this evening's discussion is offered very much in that spirit of pausing to talk and debate and reflect on the history of the park and the legacy of planning and design decisions that have created it in its present form, and seeing what we might learn and what lessons we might apply from that legacy. The history of the park is certainly too colorful and too eventful for me to cover in these opening remarks, but suffice it to say, it's a space that has been reinvented and reconceptualized over the decades, almost as often as downtown Los Angeles itself, moving from its early history when it was little more than a field with a white picket fence around it to keep the livestock out, to its design by redesigned by John Parkinson, to its being renamed for a World War I general after that war, to its to the decision after World War II to sink an underground parking garage beneath it, and finally to the 1990s redesigned by Ricardo Legarreta and Lori Olin, that gave us the, I would say, the colorful but hardscape-heavy maybe version of the park that we see today. And throughout much of that history, the same group of questions have tended to swirl around the park. Namely, is it possible through design alone to restore the vital role that it once played in civic life in Los Angeles, or is that goal driven more by nostalgia than a real understanding of the roles that open space and downtown play in contemporary Los Angeles? More recently, the questions have included what role can Pershing Square play as downtown changes as it becomes more residential, perhaps more vibrant than it's been in some time. And finally, most recently, if that evolution begins to stall, or perhaps if it is already showing signs of stalling along with the economy, how do we grapple with the fact that Pershing Square, for its lack of popularity with much of the population, remains central to the lives of many of the homeless population downtown? So the question is, where does that leave us in considering Pershing Square? I think it leaves us, first of all, with a park that never seems to reach its potential or our hopes for it or our sense of the role that it played in the past before we were in Los Angeles or before we were even born, for that matter, and that now finds itself, I think, having lost some of the funding that we expected from the developers of the Park Fifth Tower, or other developments. At the same time, I think the city is moving forward with some plans for, or at least exploring some plans for some modest but not unimportant upgrades to the square, which we can get into in a bit. Particularly interested to ask Barry about those. And I think it's important, even as I'm sure we'll spend plenty of time talking about the usual list of complaints about Pershing Square and why it fails in so many ways, to pause at least for a bit at the beginning of the conversation to remember and to list what the park does offer, even in its less than perfect current condition. And that is a park that is at grade, that is of a manageable size, that's at or near the heart of downtown, with a long history as a crossroads for the city and now served by a metro stop. And that is a list of attributes when it comes to public space in Los Angeles that we, I think, ought not to scoff at. So that's the backdrop to the conversation. But before we dive into that, recognizing that I think to make the square work, we're going to have to consider some ideas and some models for parks from cities all over the country and all over the world, We're going to turn to Daniel Biederman to talk about his experience with Bryant Park and with other projects in New York. And then we'll get into a broader discussion with the panel and leave some time for some questions and comments from you all in the audience. So, Daniel.
It's humbling to criticize the architecture profession.
The architecture critic of the New York of the LA Times here. Any architects? More important question. All right. I wanted to see how many people I'd offend in the next 2.5 minutes. Okay, here we go. What shouldn't Pershing Square do? I'm going to show you the work of 4-star architects. Look at the public spaces in front or around them. Frank Gehry. Kuhlhaas, Meyer, Hadid. I don't think these, there are no people in the pictures because of the time the pictures were taken. Very often with the star architects, the public space is an afterthought. That's one thing I think you ought to avoid, more discussion later. I would argue a lot of the spaces around their buildings really are serving as forecourts for the display of the architecture rather than carefully thought out programs and sprucings that are necessary to make a public space attractive. But there's a landscape architecture. How many landscape architects can I offend? Raise your hands. Couple, okay. And there's one on the panel, Kathleen. I've already apologized to her. I'm grasping for a term that's analogous to your Hollywood high concept. Those of you who are involved in Hollywood in some way, I think high concept is a movie that can be explained in one sentence, the plot of which can be explained in one sentence, and that carries the movies in some way. We, in our office, use the term high concept differently for landscape architecture. It's parks that have a viewpoint that very often seems to emerge from the intellectual deliberations within a landscape architecture firm, and some of those people seem to me somewhat like the star architects. I only picked two to criticize, and they're both from Paris, oddly enough. Parc de la Villette, which is much celebrated, and in the opinion of me, and I have one other supporter, Alex Garvin, a planner in New York. You may know him, who's written a number of books. We hate this park. Anybody seen it? Parc de la Villette, very famous. You're supposed to go see it. I really think they missed the boat. So that's some of the high concept of Parc de la Villette, and Citroën is a closer call. Anybody seen Citroën in Paris? It's on the Seine, a couple people. Not clear to me what was achieved at Citroën by some of these, what seemed to me, intellectual concepts. I was glad to hear Christopher mention that Pershing Square is at grade. That's a great asset to be treasured. Citroën tries not to be at grade, which is, in the teachings of my mentor, William H. White, exactly what you should not be trying to do. So this is the don'ts. And then, of course, being an egotistical presenter myself, I'm now going to show you what I think the do's are, which are mine. but I apologize for that, because a lot of other people are onto this too, not just us. But this is Bryant Park. This stuff is more inexpensive. And if you took a vote in the public about which they like more, I think they'd vote for softscape. Christopher also mentioned hardscape, Pershing Square. The public likes softscape, classical architecture, and soft kind of designs. The public hates modernism and hardscape, and that vote's been had already. It's 99-1 or 98-2, I might concede, if you fought with me for an hour. The public's voted already. Public knows what it likes. So why are we still playing this game of trying to convince them that they like modernism, either in architecture design or landscape architecture design? So you see how inexpensive the stuff we do is. Kiosk, this is actually Hugh Hardy's work. This is what the programming, I'm into my second pitch here, which is programming is what will win the day at Pershing Square. And there's just not enough programming there now. There's a lot of symbolic architecture, but not enough programming. So everything from serving food, as those other slides showed, to just having concessions that have chess, checkers, and backgammon, movies at night. I'm going to roll through this very quickly because I don't have much time. Carousels, Most of the cities I go to, when I ask them, where's the nearest carousel? The answer is always 35 miles away. So I say, hey, great, we can entice your young people to this park that you want to populate, because 35 miles is a long way. It's almost always about 35 miles, usually an amusement park somewhere very far out. Richmond, that was the case, Atlanta, no carousels. So carousels work. We have a reading room, and it was interesting to see in the slides of Pershing, they had a reading room back at the same time Bryant did. And Bryant had it in the 30s. We reestablished it 6 years ago. It's very simple, books, newspapers, magazines, let people borrow them, trust that they'll return them. It's a terrific creator of activity. Wi-Fi, hugely significant and draws huge crowds. I have another slide people always laughed at with huge snowdrifts and people doing Wi-Fi in our park on these chairs. It's about 20 degrees. They're addicted to looking at Wi-Fi in our park for some reason. But I don't have that slide here. Now, this is a before and after of two other parks in Manhattan. These colors are a little washed out here for some reason, but that's Herald Square, tiny little park, across from Macy's, very famous because of the song. That's before. That's after. It's really, here we haven't programmed much because we don't have room. So this is soft stuff. Movable chairs, Holly White, those of you, you seem like an intelligent audience, I can tell from the nods, so most of you know of the work of Holly White. Movable chairs, movable chairs, movable chairs. There are some in Pershing Square, but not enough. We have 3,800 in Bryant, and the movable chairs and the flowers and the different lighting and a little bit of programming have really made this a much more pleasant space. This is the parallel, just to the south, Greeley Square, named after Horace Greeley. Before, this is after we took the drug sellers and the criminals out of it, but it was dull as hell because nobody other than they was there. So that's the before shot, and this is what we did after. This stuff is inexpensive, and it's real debate in Pershing whether you'd really want to go back and remake the entire landscape because it's going to be very expensive to remove all that symbolic stuff and start over. We ought to debate that later. I hope we're setting the stage for that. This is stuff that doesn't come out of my head. This is the exhibit that shows it. And forget the details, but anything with a green dot is something that a client of ours in Dallas expressed through about 70 people who lived in uptown Dallas, basically, said that they liked. We asked them, would you like to see in this park we're designing for you cafes and restaurants, retail kiosks, tree groves, jogging trails, plaza, children's playground, etc. Anything with green was something they basically said yes, they wanted, and we decided to do. Anything in red, which is the stuff on the right for the most part, we said there wasn't enough support. So in each local area, you go in and ask what kind of programming you'd like. Now, we're into a second section, much less controversial. Very hard to rely on government funding. Always, not just in 2009. Government funding was never a good backing for public park operations. It's always the first to go. So I was a private sector type guy anyway when I started this thing. I said, you know, I'm comfortable with that. Let's not take government funding. And then later on, we learned that it was also a bad idea to take private philanthropic money. So I start out my speeches sometimes on revenue by saying, we don't take a dollar of government or private philanthropic money. And a lot of people raise their hands and say, what else is there? And there is other stuff, especially in media capitals like LA, big cities with sophisticated players with a lot of money sloshing around, even in bad times. There's still money, not much of it now, but there's still money from the private sector. So this chart basically shows the sources, and government support is red, and you can see it disappears in about 97. We decided we didn't want to take government money anymore, and there's no private philanthropy there. The money for Bryant Park, which is about $8 million a year now for 6 acres, comes from park events, which we call park usage there, restaurant rent, assessments, concessions, and grants and contributions, but they really aren't. They're sponsorships. So More about that if anybody's curious about the financial methods. Here's an exhibit that shows you the revenue budget 2 years ago. And it is possible to do this, but not always in a city. We work in smaller cities, Newark, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, harder there. Not in L.A. This could be done in L.A. So Pershing Square has a lot of potential here. From another city, here's an idea of what can be done. This is the Public Garden in Boston, which is a client of ours now, one run by a fabulous guy who should really move to LA and help you. Henry Lee is his name, a Yankee. He's somehow convinced all the people, the other ethnic groups, that a Yankee should be allowed to do this. He's done a wonderful job. Any of you from Boston who know about his work? Henry Lee. So that's the Public Garden. Right next to it is Boston Common. These photos don't look so bad because they're from the spring, but Boston Common is in terrible condition, and it relies totally on government money, and Henry is just starting to work on it with us. So an abrupt contrast, government funding versus basically private funding. Public Garden versus Boston Common in Boston. Last thing I think Pershing Square should focus on, and then we'll get on to the panel's opinions. Managing, what should I call this section? Managing attendance, which is more sophisticated than you think. Obviously, you want more people. Pershing Square, in my visits the last 2 days, has reinforced my belief that it rarely has either many people in it. Of course, this is not perfect weather for you, but in New York, we celebrate 55 degrees. And but you, admittedly, this is not high season in LA. But in the summer, except at certain times, it does not draw a lot of people. And more important, it's not drawing healthy male-female ratios. The way to tell the health of a park, Holly White always taught, go into a public space, count the first 50 people you see. If it comes out 26 women, 24 men, great. Stay there, set up camp, be there all afternoon. Bring your baby in. Sit with your office friends if you're a woman. If it's 42 men and 8 women, not good. Get out immediately. Women vote with their feet much more aggressively than men do. They're well aware of physical problems, threats to their security. So we count every, not only to see that what we're doing is successful, we have a lot of people, we count men and women. And the pink is women, the blue is men. It's about 50-50 always. And that's a measure of success. And Pershing Square isn't there. And even more important, the male-female, homeless, non-homeless ratio is very unhealthy. You do not have to do a thing about homeless citizens as long as they're obeying the rules, as long as the ratio between homeless to non-homeless is in the right number. And the right number is about 300 or 400 to 1. So Bryant Park has 13 people. We know everything about them. We know their life stories. They live there. They're homeless people. But we have 4,200 others. So women come into the park and they don't say, ooh, this is a homeless hangout, I'm getting out of here immediately, because they see that it's safe for them, and that, therefore the homeless people are fine, they can stay. And you don't want to get into the business of pushing out homeless people. You want to get into the business of drawing so many others that it's not really visible that there are large numbers of homeless people there, and it's comfortable to women who are your key constituents. So we track visitation very carefully. There's all kinds of statistical analysis done by my 22-year-olds who taught to do this. This exhibit got screwed up, but this is a park in Dallas where we actually do an analysis of what we call as market share from the neighborhood. How many people do we need to draw from adjacent office towers, residential buildings, and the like, college campuses, and what percentage can we achieve versus Bryant Park? Here we show that we can be successful in Woodruff. I'm sorry, this is actually in Atlanta Park, Woodruff Park. We did the same analysis in Dallas, but this one is the park in the downtown Atlanta office district right near the Five Points subway station. And here we determined we only needed 1.1% of the likely visitors to do well, and they're on their way to achieving that. The client is Central Atlanta Progress, and they're doing extremely well. It would be a good approach for Pershing Square. So I end with a couple of shots of the randomness of park distribution. If you use movable chairs, I haven't talked about those, but they're very important. I haven't talked enough about them, why they work. But that's the movable chair-oriented park, distributing the attendance extremely well, and people using the park the way they'd like, because in the teachings of Holly White, there's a place for them to sit, and they can sit exactly where they want to sit. I think that's it. It is. Thank you very much for listening, and look forward to the rest of the panel.
Is that good? Okay. So you raise a whole range of questions that I hope we can get into. And I think you also make a handful of claims that I think that I can disagree with, and maybe some others can. And I think that's good for the conversation going forward. Particularly, I think the critique of star architecture is absolutely valid. But I do think there's a discussion we can have about design itself as a kind of programming now, given the I think the interest that the public has developed over the last decade or two in high design projects, even if some of them fail in terms of the public space that they create, I think there is a kind of public interest in, to a level now that you could at least make the case that design itself, if done, executed at the right kind of level, can be its own programming for a space. But before we get into that kind of a conversation, let's go back to some specifics, and I want to start with Doug. Let me ask you from your point of view, for I know this is a Pershing Square is a space that you've studied, you've thought a lot about over the years, you've developed some design proposals for. So I want to ask you first to give us your analysis from your point of view of why the park doesn't work and what are the problems that we need to grapple with as we think about reconceptualizing it or taking it back to an earlier period of success or prominence in the city.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who spend more time downtown and in and around the park than I do to analyze the specific problems of it. But I often give tours to Fulbright scholars, to groups of Fulbright scholars from around the world, and I always start on the steps of this building and talk about McGuire Gardens and the library and Cafe Pino and a mix of high and low, everybody's comfortable. I think we do have a very successful model outside this door of public space. It puts to lie the just tiresome argument that people in LA are somehow this weird aberrant species who don't gather in public space and don't want it and so forth. I mean, those I just find that tiresome. And it's actually often a rationalization for designs that are devoid of people, because apparently the people don't want it, so we find a design as if they won't come, and surely they don't. But when you design it in a way that you want them and expect them, they show up in large numbers, and the Palisades Park in Santa Monica is filled with people. Yes, it's got a view of the ocean, but there's nothing going on there. There's nothing to buy. There's nothing to sell. It's just the space and the gathering. And yes, a beautiful view, but Angelenos love public space, love gathering. Can I think that we should just set that aside as a sort of absurd claim that has justified other agendas over the years. And this space proves it. For me, this, you know, I think of this space, this is kind of like the Tom Hanks of public space. You know, just hugely successful, everybody loves it, friendly, unthreatening. And Pershing Square is kind of the Mickey Rourke of public space. Anyway. Tough, you know, had its ups and downs over the years, and hopefully ready for a big comeback. I mean, a big comeback. But the question is why? And, you know, I don't want to take too much time because we'll talk about it, and I think both Christopher and Dan mentioned possibilities. But, you know, I've said, oh, what's the problem? I have studied the history of it. It has been redesigned. I think it's in its sixth or seventh incarnation right now. But the Parkinson design was of the highest level and probably socially the most successful, at least from the documentary evidence, filled with people and of all kinds doing a range of things in harmonious public space. It was a very simple design. The real change, the real rupture, was in the 50s when, of course, we had to rip out that successful design, and not to mention the soil and the mature trees that you saw, and put in a parking structure underground. Of course, we had to do it. It was L.A. in the 50s, and we did it. So it's, in my view, it's never really recovered from that rupture. Now, does that mean you can't have a parking structure underneath? Well, guess what? McGuire Gardens has a parking structure underneath. So it can be done. Union Square in San Francisco, which is actually very similar if you think about it, has the, is it the mm-hmm. St. Francis or the Sir Francis Drake? I get them mixed up. But the big hotel, St. Francis at one end, like the Biltmore, analogous. But it has a number of advantages. It's got the major central shopping district, Macy's and so forth, around it. And it's half the size. I used to think they were the same. I just checked. It's at 2.7 acres, and Pershing Square is 5. So it proportionally, it looks about the same, but it's actually tiny. But it has parking, and it was redesigned recently with parking underneath, and it's actually quite successful. So the parking shouldn't necessarily kill possibilities for redesign, although I do think the particular structure here is a bear. I mean, the ramps, and they tried to get their arms around it in the latest redesign, but I still think it is disruptive. And though Dan's right technically that it's at grade, it's on a hump. I mean, it rises. And that rise, as was famous in Bryant Park, that, you know, the analysis was just those two or three steps, that much that you had to walk up, right, made the drug dealers feel safe and everybody else feel unsafe. So even slight changes in elevation, it's an artificial change in elevation. It's an artificial hump. I think it would make an enormous difference. You sense it if that ground was a flat slope from one side to the other. And, of course, let's not talk about visual transparency. I mean, Project for Public Spaces warned in Legareta and Olin and the team that were designing it, too many walls, it's not transparent. And they were not listened to. They predicted a certain amount of, if not failure, at least problems. And I think one feels that you can't see through it properly, and when you're in it, you can't see out properly. It's disconnected from the surround. What's wrong with it? I mean, why? Is it in the wrong place? If you draw a line from Union Station to Staples Center, there's a diagonal line. The centroid of downtown has been moving south and west progressively for about 160 years. And it's moved, and Pershing Square for a long time was right at that centroid. Arguably now it's down at about maybe Hope and 7th or Figueroa or Flower and 8th, it's moved, but Pershing Square is still very much in the center of downtown, and I think it's not in the wrong location. Kevin Lynch said it had a big problem. It was one block away from the two big streets. He analyzed that there's 7th and there's Broadway, and darn it, how come Pershing Square isn't on one of those streets? It's a block from Broadway, it's a block from 7th. Big problem. Well, there are a lot of parks that work without being right on the main street. I don't think that's it either. I do think the loss of the Philharmonic, if you think of all the issues with the Music Center over the year in Grand Avenue, the biggest thing that the Music Center did was yank, I mean, I don't know if it was the cause, but it yanked the Philharmonic, or the Philharmonic left the north face of Pershing Square. That big hole for me is not mentioned often enough. I mean, when you're on the north side of a park, that's the side that gets illuminated all day long. Mm-hmm. You tend to be less aware of what's on the south side. That north side is just a big gaping hole and has been for how many years? 40 years. So the absence of an important use, any use, but the fact that it was the Philharmonic makes it particularly tragic. And, you know, it migrated up to Bunker Hill. And there's the title guarantee building, you know, hanging on for dear life, recently about to be totally surrounded by a monstrous tower, which, you know, might have been a good thing, but that's off the table. So I don't think it's the size. I don't think it's the location. The surroundings could be better. The jewelry district's great and, you know, wonderful that so many folks are gainfully employed, but it's a lousy use next to a park because it's high security, limited hours, sucks everybody inside. It's not a terrific adjacent use. So that is somewhat problematic. Is it society and social conditions? Well, we talked about that. I don't think so. This park works fine under the same conditions. Programming, yeah. I mean, clearly that's got to be part. I think under the way our society handles public space now, Dan, just makes a great case for programming. Design. I mean, I'm working my way back to, so is it the fault of the design then, finally? And, you know, I'm sympathetic. By the way, you didn't come down hard enough on architects, because even Parc de la Villette was designed not by a landscape architect, but by an architect. So you see, even in park design, we do our damage. But I think the design was, you know, full of heart and well-intentioned and trying very hard to succeed, but I think the design is a failure. I mean, given the objectives, I think we just have to acknowledge that. Now, you know, we can talk about the why and the specifics. The real dilemma that's going to face the commissioners and the city and those around it is, okay, one more time, do we rip it out and start over? Are there things that we can do to improve it? That Dan, you seem to be suggesting that, you know, let me at it with my low-cost solutions and programming, and we could fix that place. And I suspect maybe you could. I'd like to see a little demolition, just some selective demolition, a few things, but maybe not wholesale. The parking, though, I think is even you, Dan, might have trouble getting around those parking ramps and the impact that they have, the vents and the railings so that to me remains the outstanding question: is can you overcome the particularities of that parking structure design? I mean, I'd love to see it go. We've built a billion-dollar subway with a portal right there. Why do we have to let people come right into Pershing Square and park into there? I'd say close it, you know, turn it into underground cinemas, get rid of the ramps, use it as space for theater or whatever, and get rid of the cars. That might open it up. All right, I went on too.
No, I think thank you. That's a very, I think that really explains and kind of elucidates the vague sense of dissatisfaction that many of us have in looking at and moving around the edges and using the park. And I think programming certainly is a subject that we'll get back to. I think also bearing in mind that the Civic Park that's part of the Grand Avenue project that I mentioned is also banking pretty heavily on programming as a way to draw crowds. And there's, I think, a question about whether that becomes a competition and how these parks can either work together or whether that becomes a kind of zero-sum game or not. But let me turn to Kathleen and following on Doug's critique, you've been working with students and thinking in your own right about some solutions to the problems that he just laid out. So if you could tell us what you've been coming up with as some ways to get over these problems, to deal with these obstacles that he listed.
Well, one fantasy that I have is that we take those round structures that are in the park and we put a little hook on them, and then we kind of start to swing them in some directions, and that might be a good way to start some of that selective demolition. But I think the walls are really the biggest impediment to the park, and really beginning to just take those walls down, even if you don't really look at a complete redo of the park. In this quarter, the students are looking at both fixes and the complete redo. And I think that inability, and especially as a woman, and I'll just say it, going into that space is very scary. Even when I take my students on a tour, I find myself looking behind me to see where they are, because I don't really want to walk ahead of the group, especially when I go through the Dead Sculpture Garden. That's just a place that is, you know, you walk through this space. The statues are not talking to each other the way they were set up to be. They're kind of all looking off in different directions. And then there's a tunnel that's ahead, and the smell is overwhelming, and I'm like, where, I know I've got like, you know, 50% of my class are males. Where are they right now? Go, come on, guys, we're going this way. So some of that is just opening it up. Just take down the walls, take out that tunnel, whatever that is, that overhead, that purple overhead. Open that up, begin to get some transparency into it.
Because not all those walls, right, are connected to the ramps. I mean,
no, they're not. And one of the students said they went up to the pink bollards, and they're hollow. They said it would really take nothing to take them down. They're not. They're tapped on them, and they're pretty. You know, they're pretty open. So I think and one of the questions that we had a lot in the class is, do you do the master plan and wait? Or do you try to do fixes in between? And personally, I said to them, I think we need to do both. I'm really grateful that we've been able to work with Russ Brown with the Downtown Neighborhood Council and Patty Berman, who's running the Parks Committee. And the need for open space, quality open space downtown, is immediate. And so to take some money and fix it, I think is doable. Get some of those big pots and put some trees in there with some, you know, impatiens around the bottom. Get a little, not a dog park, but a place that can capture, you know, the excrement from the dogs and treat it. There are devices out there now that can do that. Put in the movable chairs. The book that I have my students read right off the bat is The Social Life of Small Urban Spaces by William White. He looked at all of those spaces in New York. They came up with what the issues were. And one of the problems that I have with the STAR architects or the STAR landscape architects is they need to go back to school and they need to do their basic site analysis right off the bat. And if you understand that we're in LA where it's hot, and you know, another one is the Noguchi Plaza in Little Tokyo, that you go there in the summertime, and if you want to give the best illustration of what a heat island effect is, you go to these two places. And so I think we should fix it, and the students are looking at these short-term fixes. If you don't deal with the homeless and you don't put a bathroom in there, the park becomes the bathroom. As we get to have more downtown residents, and if you don't deal with the dogs are going to create a dog park. So look at your site analysis and do your homework. Do your demographic analysis. See who's there. See who the park users are. And begin to really start to immediately program the space to be better. But then let's really look at, yes, we are in my opinion, and no offense, the best city in the United States, and we deserve to have not just Pershing, it's not an either or, it's not just Pershing Square or the other one, but all the above. And let's have this be the Central Park again that it really should be for downtown.
Thank you, Kathleen. Let me turn to Barry Sanders and ask about prospects for some of these plans. There's been talk a little bit in the press and on the blogs about some more modest efforts to think about perhaps a dog park and think about some changes to the park as it stands. I know that there's been some discussion in Jan Perry's office about that. So I want to ask you what you can tell us about where those plans stand now, and also what, in your view, are the prospects for a more major fix or overhaul?
Thank you, Chris. First, let me acknowledge on behalf of myself, and I'm sure on behalf of my colleagues on the panel, our thanks to the Library Foundation and the Aloud program. I was chairman of the Library Foundation, and I appreciate the work that Carolyn Wagner does and all the staff here in putting on this series. I appreciate your coming here for it. Oh, and do throw money in that glass case. Also, I appreciate the presence here. Russ Brown has already been acknowledged, and his work for the Park Advisory Board on Pershing Square is very important and valuable for all of us. And John Kirk Muckry, the general manager of the Rec and Parks Department, my partner in all this. Thanks for coming. As to the question, let me take it in a different order, maybe starting with the second half of the question and getting back to it. You might imagine that the role of a person here who's the president of the Recreation and Parks Commission, and then hearing from all these fine panelists about what's wrong with the department, that my role would be to be the punching bag. I refuse to play the role. I've been coming downtown since 1970 every day, and I have felt that Pershing Square, as then it existed, and certainly as now it exists, is a serious problem for us all. The 1992 design, I didn't think it was any good then, and I don't think it's any good now. Now, I'm not the only person in town, and our job on the commission and at the department with its 10,000 employees is to listen to the people of Los Angeles. And I know there are actually people out there who don't agree with me on this, or actually anything else I'd say. We would listen, and we'll listen to this, and we appreciate this initiative enormously to get a ball rolling in the direction I'd like to see it roll, which is to make very major changes in Pershing Square, to make it work for all of us. These considerations deal with architecture, but they also deal with programming, and they also deal with demographics and the city plan. It's not limited to what's within our perimeter in Pershing Square. So let me speak just about my own opinions about it for a while. These are not opinions of the commission or the city. The commission acts as five people when we vote, so these would just be my views. My view, as I told you, is that the square doesn't work as it is. I think the architecture is heavily responsible. As Kathleen says, the walls are inherent central part of Legoretto's design. He's creating Zocalo in the middle of the city, and he must have thought, I assume from looking at it, I didn't speak with him, that the park was too large and that there's a more compressed space. Once you're inside all those walls, it's actually not that bad. There's a lot of hardscape, but there's a lot of hardscape right out here in front too. But enclosed, once you're in it, it's not that bad. But getting in it is a serious problem. You have walls, you have, just as Doug said, the park elevated above grade, which is also true at Union Square, but that works. But it's elevated above grade, and worse than that, around those walls on the other side is high shrubbery, presumably higher than when Legoretto had it planted, because it's grown through the department's excellent work, John. But it does continue to hide what's going on inside, and if you're inside, you feel, as Kathleen says, threatened by the walls. And then it also limits ingress and egress, the last thing you'd want to do. You can only get in basically at the corners. There's a split in it in the middle on the eastern and the western side, but basically you're limited to ingress and egress. And then, no fault of Legoretto, but a fault of the lack of ambition of that redo, is the fact that you're still surrounded, as you were before, by about 6 to 7 or 8 lanes of traffic on all four sides, depending how many lanes you consider those ramps to take up. So you're not walking across a New York street. And I might add Bryant Park, which I think is wonderful, is only streets on 3 sides. And this very successful park here is streets on 2 sides. Mm-hmm. You're surrounded on 4 sides by freeways, basically. You can't cross those streets except with a crosswalk sign. You come in on the corners. When we put in a subway in this town, do we have it let its exit out as they do in London in the park, so you walk out of the park from when you get out of the subway? No, it's on the other side. So that throughput of people is denied to us. It's on the other side. And worse than that, the way they built the subway, they cleared that block permanently and forever from anything there that would occupy people. So that's another gaping hole in the teeth around the front there. So you've got the hole at Philharmonic Hall, which would have been filled with Park Fifth and would have been a wonderful thing for this park. And you've got a hole there that'll never be filled. You have vacant buildings at the southwest corner. And you have residential only in the title guarantee building. The Biltmore turned its back on the park in the 1990s, not to return. So whatever else you may say about population and whether it's at the center of the city or not, this park is where no people are. And the way a park works, in my personal opinion, is the people. It can be dirt and bricks, but if there's lots of people there, it's working. And if there's lots of people there, it doesn't matter whether there's homeless among them, as someone has already said. So what we'd like to see is a couple of changes. It would be wonderful if the park were no longer on the edge of what is really the downtown population of people walking, but rather we're in the center of it. And we saw that beginning to happen with the development that that the city was having. My son lives at 6th and Main, but the current economic climate has made us have to wait for that. I think it'll come, but we're years away from it. And the other thing we need is a park that itself doesn't keep the people, by its design, doesn't keep the people who are there away from it. So we, absent the return of the people to the neighborhood who are so overwhelming in numbers as they are in other cities, as they are around Boston, Boston's parks, the Public Garden, the Boston Common, there's a ton of people right on the perimeter. We don't have it. People don't go so many blocks for a park to just sit and read a newspaper in. They only go a short distance. We don't have that. We may get there. But what we do have is exacerbating the problem by walling the park off and making it an island that no one can swim to. So what you can do when you're the Rec and Parks Department is two things. You can fight for a change in the design. You can encourage not only the people in this panel, but all the people in the room who have, and the people out there who have tremendous interest in this park, to let's get going, let's start a movement. We'll be at the head of the parade, not running after it, for a complete redesign of this park. Call in an airstrike. Take out the garage and put one in. Put in a garage. We need it for the revenue. You can't have no garage. But put it in a big bathtub that goes from the wall of the Biltmore to the wall of the Jewelry Mart and north-south, too. So you've got twice as many cars in there and therefore twice as much revenue. And then, with the park that you've put above, find a way to sink the streets on at least two sides so that you don't have this terrible island effect and you have people who can reach it. And then, as this is all happening, presumably because it'll take many years, we'll even have some population grow right on its perimeter. But in the meantime, until it's happened, the only way we get that population in the park is by modest changes to the park's physical attributes. I think they should be more modest than people here say, if only out of the ethics of respecting the Legoretto design as much as I don't like it. But there are things we can do in terms of redesign that'll bring people in. We've got sidewalks, believe it or not, outside the walls of these parks, right along the curb, all around, so people don't have to come in. Reroute those sidewalks inside. Get rid of the high shrubs and put grass. We've got plans for these that we can bring to the people in the Park Advisory Board and start the process. And the other thing to do is what we're already doing. I don't think Dan gave us enough credit on this. We program the park not as intensively as we can, not as intensively as we will, but fairly intensively. 5 nights a week concerts, winter and summer. 2 months of a very successful ice skating rink. We've got an art show there all summer long. I hope you'll come to St. Patrick's Day parade and show there that's going to be there on the 17th. We're talking to the folks who run the marathon about having events coinciding with the marathon at the park. We're in final talks about bringing the farmer's market that's out here on 5th Street every Wednesday to the park, and I think we will, starting in April. And then to go to Chris's question, in terms of physical changes, while I think they need to be relatively modest. And one other thing I mentioned. At the behest of the Park Advisory Board, we are looking at unconventional ways from the city's contracting practices to try to get a restaurant back in there. It's hard. Again, it's population-centered as to whether they can succeed. prior attempts, and there have been prior attempts in that restaurant facility that's there, have failed due to lack of business. But we're going back at it. We're going to try again to see what we can do in terms of bringing people there that way. We also are looking at some physical changes. When I became president of the commission, I asked to be shown all 400 parks in the city. And when we talk about planning, we will benefit enormously from all the thoughts of everybody in the public and certainly the thoughts of professionals. But I also want to say a word. We've got planning people in the department, and we've got 400 parks. They have some real expertise to bring to the game, too, and we do that. With their help, we've put in front of the Park Advisory Board a dog park plan for the south side of the park. But I asked to see all 400 parks, but I particularly wanted to see Pershing Square because of my pre-existing judgments about it. And John Muckery and a team went with me last February. We looked at it. It wasn't a bad day. It was pretty clean. It had rained. And it seemed to me that the Palm Court, the northeast corner, was the single worst part of the park. And I've heard it mentioned already, and apparently there's agreement on that. It seemed to obviously be a place of assignations for the demi-monde. And it smelled like it. We got the ball rolling immediately to do a redesign there. We were ready to roll, and then we thought, and we were told that was right, that we needed to have further community input. We took it back to Russ and Dan Swartz and the Neighborhood Council and Park Advisory Board, got more input, held it up for 6 months. So we've changed it a little. We've tweaked it. In 2 weeks, construction will begin in the northeast corner to bring new plantings, new grass, some steps, and make it look good in what has been that palm court. We won't move the statues yet, but I'd love to. That Beethoven's there because he used to be across from Philharmonic Hall. That's why he's there. He was given by the musicians. And so project will take a couple of months. There'll be new irrigation, and we will have a pet care feature. Maybe someday we will have a dog park, but absent that, there'll be a pet care feature there that dogs can go to. It's a happening thing. We also have changed the management and folks among some of the people managing the park to make sure it's kept right, and that's happening too, all in consultation with the community. Thank you.
So thank you. So just to clarify on that last point, folks should begin to see those changes by early summer, the ones that you were just describing?
I think it'll take like 2 months or so max. Things get hard when they're over a garage and so on. Yeah, we're doing it ourselves instead of contracting it out to make it fast. No RFPs. We're done wasting time.
Let me turn finally to Lewis. And Lewis, you think about downtown in a broader and more holistic way than almost anybody else I know, and about the connections between various parts, and of course connections between downtown and the river. So I want to ask you to tell us a bit from your point of view about the connections between Pershing Square and the rest of downtown as you see them, and some of the opportunities beyond the more specific problems with the park and the perimeter of the park that we've talked about so far.
Wow. I mean, I feel, and in fact am, an amateur in this panel, and somewhat of a dilettante. My primary interest has been the Los Angeles River for the last 25 years, and my specialty is not giving up on lost causes, and I think that one of the things that I've heard tonight, and it's sort of amazing how completely unanimous is everybody's attitude about Pershing Square, and that's the way people were about the Los Angeles River in 20 years ago. If they knew where Los Angeles River was, they thought of it in a way as essentially the way we think of Pershing Square, which is a kind of a day room in a mental hospital during the day. And a no man's land at night, and I have seen that attitude change about the Los Angeles River. One of the things that's been most interesting to me in the last couple of years is how many people come up to me and say, "Wow, the river's really looking good. It's just amazing how much it's changed." And the truth is, it hasn't really changed at all. But what's happened is people's minds have been changed about the river. They see the things about the river that are optimistic. They see the things about the river that they overlooked before, because if you look, we did a 15-minute montage from movies that we just could pirate out of a video store of scenes shot in the LA River. in every single scene except the race in Greece was a scene of anomie and despair and loneliness. And that has been the attitude about the Ali River, and it's certainly the attitude about Pershing Square. And I think that like Pershing Square, the river was ignored for many reasons, some structural, some of them cultural. But you've begun to see people taking more responsibility. And this is, I think, a really significant evening in a certain way, and I think Barry kind of touched on it. I mean, this is really kind of reaching out. I mean, we have of course, the Downtown Neighborhood Council has been involved in this issue and have parks people. But I think we're starting to reach out into a wider community of which the square is central, if only in the imagination. I don't think that, and I agree with Doug, that doesn't need to be moved 2 blocks to the south or 2 blocks. It's not, that's not the issue at all. The issue is making opening it up. The issue is welcoming, becoming a much more welcoming place. I was thinking about it because for a while I live at 7th and Spring, and I was going to the library almost every day researching on a book I've been working on. And so I would go through Pershing Square every day and hang out there for a while and sort of look at things and see things. And one of the things that I saw, and this is, you know, and I don't, again, I'm not a professional, but it's just things that I've seen when I've walked through the park. I've seen skateboarders be chased out of the park. I've seen the places where that they can go down on the narrow handrails altered so that they can't go down on the narrow handrails. And it's not like I'm a skateboarder, obviously, but I know that that's a vigorous, active community of people that the park has possibilities for, and for maybe good reasons. I don't know. I'm just telling you what I see. Is skateboarders getting run out of the park? I see dwarf orange trees in the middle of the park on scalding hot days where there's no shade in the park. The only shade in the park is for the shady people over on the east side, where drug deals are going down constantly in the shadows. In the vast majority of the park, there's no place to hide from the sun, and you have these little trees, and you kind of want to get underneath it like that, you know. And that wouldn't take so much to have shade trees. And it was something that I wanted to ask Daniel actually about. Is how many trees there were in Bryant Park, and how many, and what kind of trees? I think these are again things you can do non-structurally. You can just plant trees. And remember, I mean, I'm coming from a real simple place here, not a professional place. Green to the street, trees and grass, grass and trees, maybe and walkways in between. If you see this picture, I was looking at this picture in Max Yavno's book, the Los Angeles book from 1950, and there's all these people along these little paths in the park with benches on them. Like in Central Park, I noticed every one of those benches has a name of somebody that's donated money to Central Park. I mean, that's one of those ways where you can make money. There's nothing that you would want to put your name onto now, although it's pretty funny to think if you have your name on that huge ball. and then another thing I saw walking through the park several times, and I think this is a question, it is a programming question in a sense. At 2 o'clock, I remember last summer, a really hot day, and there's, I don't know how many umbrellas there are, but there aren't very many, but where the ones that were, the few plastic chairs were gathered underneath these, and exactly at 2 o'clock, a guy on an electric cart comes up and makes everybody get up and takes the chairs, puts them on the back of his electric cart, and leaves. And I was just kind of fascinated and amazed by that, and because there weren't, you know, there's never very well when they do shows, there's people in the park sometimes, but on a day, in the middle of a day, there's not people strolling because, you know, you really want to have an umbrella. And so did the people sitting under the umbrella, and then suddenly they have their chairs taken out from under them like some kind of weird children's game. And, you know, and I asked the park guys, and he said, why that was happening. He says, 2 o'clock, we go to work at 6 a.m, we're done, you know, as if that meant that the park was finished for the day. You know, so So it's just small things. And the restaurant. I mean, the problem with the restaurant is that it's like a bunker. You should have, like, sandbags around it, you know. And because it has that look of, you know, like out on the edge of the DMZ, and maybe in a certain way it is. But I think that I completely agree, there has to be places to eat in the park. But I mean, I don't think that's the way that's constructed is the way that it's going to work. And until there's trees, because then you got to be outdoors, and then there's no shade. So why would you sit there and eat?
And speaking of shade, thank you, Lewis.
I have one more thing.
Yeah, please.
I think that it's past time to change the name of the park. I mean, John J. Pershing was the guy that led the army that invaded Mexico. And I think that is not a symbol of Los Angeles present or future. And I would recommend that the name of the park be changed to the great Mexican poet, philosopher Octavio Paz. I think it should be called Peace Park, Paz Park. So that's my suggestion for the evening. So,
thank you. Let me follow on something you mentioned and turn back to Daniel on the subject of shade, which I think we could do a whole separate panel on shade and in Los Angeles. It's always amazing to me how little attention architects seem to pay to that, and in terms of city projects, it's amazing just to drive around and see how people are sitting or standing waiting for the bus where there's absolutely no shade structure, and they sort of align themselves in the little tiny stripe of shade that's created by a pole and wait there with, you know, half of their face shaded until the bus comes. And I think even with new projects where theoretically that should be at the center of how we think about open space, these things somehow get lost in the shuffle. So, Daniel, the question about trees in Bryant Park, obviously we're talking about a different climate, but you want to tell us about the landscaping and the
trees in climate, were there? We're in climate zone 6.5. You're a 9. If you want to learn about shade in parks, pay attention to the masters, which is the French. Parc de la Villette aside, the French are brilliant park designers, managers, understanders of programming, and most of the work in France has been outstanding, especially Paris. And you see two trees over and over and over again in that climate zone, and I'm not sure if they'd work here. Somebody shout out if you're a horticulturist or arborist. London Plains, which is what Bryant Park has, all of them planted on the same day by Robert Moses, September 10th, 1934. They're 74 years old, soon to be 75. And chestnuts, which for obvious reasons have been a challenge in the East Coast because of a blight, but they have large leafed and they're very impressive. Go through that, this French parks, you'll see them all over. I've never understood why Miami and Los Angeles like palm trees. And I've asked that of a lot of people, and I've heard a lot of arguments about hurricanes in the case of Miami. I don't know what the argument is here, but the shade is obviously minimal, and you need it more than we do, because if you really, in New York and the East Coast in general, the Northeast Corridor, the number of sunny days is fewer than 50%, the number of sunny hours.
Well, just quickly, you mentioned architects' egos. There are sometimes stories that architects like palm trees because they don't get in the way of the architecture the way that provides more shade does.
And there was a period in which calorie pears were continually specified by architects because they have these ethereal small leaves, and you can see right through them to the show, which is the architecture. Is that right? That's a shame, because the French really rely on them.
But in terms of Bryant Park, you had an existing collection of mature trees, obviously.
We didn't really get an inheritance there, because when I started working on the park, some sage arborist said to me, shame that you're doing all this, throwing out the drug sellers, fixing this park, because the second you get it done, all those London Plains are going to die of anthracnose, which is the blight that they have. And I said, what do I do to prevent anthracnose? They said, you root feed and you prune and you do all these things. So I did. I found all this money to do it. And I said, I'm not letting those trees die. And they're thriving now. So it's a key part of the park to protect those.
I think just in answer to your question about the palm trees, I think the reason that we love them so much is because they're really not trees. They're really architectural columns. And so when you think about the way we deal with our landscape, they're the perfect tree because they don't look like a tree. They look like a column. And I think the other thing is the problem that we have with Pershing Square is that it looks great in plan view. And palm trees are so wonderful in plan view. They have these gorgeous rosettes. And if you look down at them and if you look at any of the aerial photographs, you'll see how beautiful they look. And that's why we use them. Not because, and I think that's one of the faults in not doing the site analysis, is that you don't put yourself at the ground level and walk through the space. And you're absolutely right about, I mean, I've done it too, where you find that little pole or that little piece of the palm tree and try to get the shade. But I think that's why we love palm trees, is if you're an architect, they look like architecture.
Yeah, plan view park designing is a long tradition. There is a sort of, there's an outdoor park-like space at the Union Bank building across about a block from here, above the garage. Seldom is a human on it because it's elevated again above the street. But when you look down on it from the high rise that adjoins it, the Union Bank building, you see how it was designed with what used to be called a French curve, a plastic architectural template tool, because the pathways all follow the French curve. No one thought about the fact that no one would meander on that particular path if they were there. But when it comes to Pershing Square, I don't think that's as much as what happened here, because I do believe, as I said earlier, that he was creating a room, a smaller room than the buildings way out there would have created, which would have been much better. I think he had a view, especially of his towers. It's just that they don't work as a park. And, of course, the colors don't work either. The complaint Lewis could have made, too, and probably hadn't gotten to yet, about the eating area is you have Frida Kahlo colors there.
Laker fan, so...
Yeah, that's right. Well, you would not mind it, yes. But a chromium place to eat hasn't worked. But I do think that that half of Legorado is not what we want to end up with. I think it could be worse. And you have to watch out with... We're 19 years away from that design. We're sort of at the low point of appreciation for any particular style of architecture. And then 38 years out, everybody wants to know how we dared bastardize it 19 years ago. So I'm a little cautious about the more wholesale changes. A couple of things, though, I do want to mention. The General Pershing I know was a World War I guy, so maybe we should give him a pass. General MacArthur, World War II, though there was a father who was World War I, and he got a park of his own, too, so how could we take Pershing's away? As to the orange trees, I was there an hour or two ago. They're in bloom this time of year. Sure, they're too small, but they smelled so good. And they work with the palm trees because they're symbols of Southern California. You can like it or not like it, but the sun going down over the ocean with the palm trees and the orange trees is this place. Good enough anyway. Works fine. I'll take them. How did you wait around long enough to find out? Yeah. And the chair, there were chairs around the tables when I was there at 4 o'clock. And John Muckery and I are going to look into the absconding with the chairs business and make sure that doesn't happen. Oh, and the new Los Angeles Parks Foundation we've just created to raise private money, as Daniel says, to support this and all other 399 parks, is initiating its bench program, where you too can remember someone or remember yourself while still alive through buying a bench. And if you don't want them there in Pershing Square now, we can put them in Griffith Park or 398 other parks.
We have about a little bit less than 50 minutes left, so I want to open up the floor to questions because I'm sure there are more than a few. I think there's a microphone that will be passed around, so we'll take one right down here.
Yes, Jim, question. Mr. Parks calls me the sixth member of the Budget and Finance Committee. This Monday, we heard that the three retirement systems for the Los Angeles City are going to have out of the city treasury $2 billion in 2012 to 2013, $1.5 billion the year before that, and $1 billion the year before that. Now, when you consider that our entire budget that we can spend for police and fire and sanitation and parks and library is just about $2.5 billion, and you say, you're going to take $2 billion away from this, obviously, we cannot depend on public funding. But I do agree on the Pershing Square problem. Now, when I was a young boy in the 1930s, we came down regularly every week to Los Angeles downtown because that was the only place you could buy things. And when we came downtown, my mother would never set foot in Pershing Square because it was dangerous. That was in the 30s. And to my knowledge, it has never changed ever since. But the planning department has said that fences are not supposed to be more than 3 foot 6 inches high. The reason is a policeman in a police car can look over those fences as he's going down the street. They cannot do that in Pershing Square now. And the city has expanded tremendously. We've had to thin out our policemen. So we do not have the public safety that we had even in the 1930s.
So to get back to the first part of the question is
we have to cut down the height of the land in Pershing Square.
Right.
And what that means is we're going to have to do some drastic modification of that parking lot, and that means it's going to have to be private money.
Now, okay, thank you for that. We need to.
Dorothy Chandler had the same problem with the music center because no one in this city wanted the music center built because
okay,
it was
thank
not
you. I think we need to turn
valley.
Back to the first
it's
part
the
of the question,
problem.
Which is really, sir,
the private people have to do it.
Okay, thank you. I think the first part of the question is really germane to a lot of what Barry was saying, and also maybe the experience in New York, which is the planning toward, you know, driving public funding. But I also think that, you know, you mentioned the cycles of taste, architectural taste. I think there's also a really interesting cycle of public-private and the lesson, one of the interesting lessons of what's happening with the Civic Park, which is connected to the Grand Avenue, of course, is that it was a kind of stepchild for a long time to the Frank Gehry project. When the private part of the public-private development was really at the forefront, and now the park itself with money in the bank is looking like the more viable of those two projects, to be sure. So I guess the question to you first, and then if Danny wants to jump in, is the, you know, how does the city kind of plan for those ups and downs and public waxing and waning of public and private support?
We require a waxing of private support, not just for this. As I mentioned, we've created within the last few months, after years of talking about it, like 100 years of talking about it, a Los Angeles Parks Foundation, and we are soliciting funds in a variety of ways, including adopt a park, naming opportunities. If Octavio Paz wants to pay, I might name the park after him.
How much?
Well, we can talk. I don't know how much Bryant paid. So that's necessary in general, but private cannot take the place of the city's budget shortfall when we are facing yet unknown, very deep cuts in our budget. We've had a budget that a couple of years ago was at $200 million for the city, for Recreation Parks Department. It's shrunk from that already, and it's facing another significant shrinkage in the coming budget, and that affects services. Not so much at Pershing Square. We have the benefit of the parking garage, and we do have, in terms of safety, 24/7, two security people, private security people. We pay to patrol the park, and two more down in the garage. It's a safe park. It's a scary park. But in fact, we don't have the incidents that people fear. There's a difference between fear of safety and actual safety. The incidents, very few. As long as you don't include things people do with each other that would be illegal, that we don't patrol about. But the budget we've got, and the budget we're going to have next year, is going to impact hours of service at recreation centers. We have 160 across the city. Swimming pool hours, we have 60 of those. Some will be closed that should be open. We're facing real crises, and we cannot ever in any city raise private money to take the place of salaries and those sorts of things for regular programs. But we do have funds from bond issues that allow us to do capital things. And we have funds, Quimby funds they're called, for projects. Those two are going to come up shorter because if no development's happening, no monies are being put in. So it's a problem.
One caution on private money. Right now there's not much of it. I'm actually out selling myself. I've let this stuff roll in over the years on that chart, and now I have to actually sell myself. This is a very rough year. But when things do return to normal and there's more private money available, LA has a pitfall that a lot of places aren't subject to. Let me tell you 30-second story about why. I typically go to a new city, and as the consultant, I come in, and the private sector people who have raised the money for a park redesign tell me kind of nervously, we've arranged a budget for this. It's about $23 million. What do you think of that? And it depends on the size, but I very often say, I got a better idea, 2.3. What do you think? And they're ready to elect me mayor at that point. Oh, my God, you mean we don't have to raise all that money? That was going to be a pain in the neck. 2.3 would be wonderful. So I proudly tell my wife those stories when I come home. And she's from West Hollywood, grew up on North Harbor. And she sat me down when I was coming to L.A. one day and said, let me tell you something about L.A. that you don't understand. Don't use that technique you're using in the South and the Northeast and the Midwest, because they don't like that. So I said, what are you talking about? She said, I'm from L.A. and you're not, so let me explain L.A. to you. It is not a worthwhile project if it's $2.3 million. 23 might vaguely get their attention. 230 is much better. Big things are beloved in California. So when I got to the, there's press here, so I want to be careful in this description, but when I started selling Eli Broad on the idea of a park that would rely on programming between City Hall and the Music Center, and I, like so many other consultants in America, was on the team for Related's project for a short period of time. It was one of the hardest sells I've ever done, because I don't really think he wanted to do a $2.3 million park, and it actually could have been done for that. What's there now is not a disaster by any means. It just needs some tweaks, and it's a very difficult thing because of the grade differences and the garages and the like. But L.A. should stay away from the one kind of crazy thing that's been done by a great park mayor, Mayor Daley, who knows you want to hear a lot about parks from an important person. Talk to Richie Daley someday. It's amazing what he knows. He has done an unreplicable thing in Chicago, which has raised $450 million for Millennium Park, and it's not a good model for anybody. And the park is so-so. But LA's got to stay away from this. When times return to normal, don't make the projects bigger than they have to be, forgetting what the design is actually like. Do the 2.3, or if you have to, the 23. Don't do the 230.
I think that's a very good point about downtown. There's still a kind of all or nothing mentality in terms of development, when I would argue what we really need is to pay attention to the kind of connective tissue and making some connections between these behemoths that exist already. Another question. How about over here?
You know, I think maybe this is a point to step back from being so focused on the 4.5 acres Pershing Square and tie into the first panel that the Library Fund and the Red Cat had, which is, it's in a context, as many of you have said. And I was involved in the mid-80s when we put together Pershing Square Management Association around the Olympics. And what happened at the end of that process was the downtown merchants and buildings around turned their back on the park because they were afraid of the park. So what Legretto did, and he was the second team in, was to take his orders from the civic leadership, which is to turn its back on the park. So the question is, some years later, 20 years later, do we have the wherewithal in downtown to open that park up because we have the context for it? And I'm not sure, I thought we were there about a year ago. I'm not sure we're there yet. So I'd be interested in Lewis or Barry or whoever's on the panel to talk about when we take our sights off the 5 acres there at Pershing Square, do we have the context to get the people there, given the decisions that have been made over the last 20 years, and the decision still to be made.
Who wants to go first? Jump in on that?
I mean, this is hypothetical in a way, but it just seems to me that I live on the corner of 7th and Spring, and I walk up Spring a lot, and Spring is becoming a street where there are beginning to be more and more outdoor cafes. I just noticed the other night there's a guy who's got a 50-gallon drum, called it Texas Hibachi, and who's barbecuing now in front of a market, and so people are gathering in the evenings around this. So I think that, I think that it's not that hard to get people to go to a park. You know, it's not like missionary. It's not like converting them or something. You know, people want to be able to go to parks, and I think that if you have trees that give shade, and you have and you have chairs at table. You know, people, I mean, we're seeing what Daniel has accomplished in just that. And I don't think we have to spend the entire city budget to do that. I mean, whether you have to take down the whole the walls before you plant the trees. I don't think it's, I think it's easier to plant. There's even money, you know, you could raise money to get the city to give you more trees. I mean, it's just not, and the plastic chairs are what, $298 at big lots? I mean, it's not.
It's, $40 wood.
$40 wood, okay. Yep. But I'm
better than plastic.
But I just don't think that that's not the problem, I don't think.
Well, I've already said I do think it's a problem. I think that in the immediate vicinity of the park, while we had hopes that we were almost there, we're going to have to wait longer. I'm delighted by the changes that have occurred downtown. I wanted them to continue at the same pace. They haven't. So you have two issues. One is the actual number of humans working and living right on the perimeter, which is what you've got instead is gaping holes except for one building. And the second problem is that when the development stops, the additional money into capital expenditure funds stops. And we have to consider, when making decisions, not only Pershing Square as a place to expend the available capital funds, but these same humans who live downtown, on 7th Street, on 6th Street, whatever street, are asking for other green spaces. So we just bought, with Quimby funds, lots at 4th and Spring, and we're going to develop that. So we spend some of those funds on that. And there's demands from all over downtown, which is a surprisingly large area for those who don't come here much, for even closer and yet smaller spaces. So we have to make choices in limited funds. And in a boom time, easier. But the truth is, in the meantime, we're not going to wait. If we don't have the context which pours people into the park, just because they wander there, we're going to suck them in with more programming.
But wouldn't this be a great opportunity to demonstrate again the virtues of less and simplicity? I mean, Parkinson's design, Parkinson was an architect, and there weren't no architecture in Parkinson's design. I mean, why did we need an architect in the first place? Well, okay, a restaurant, maybe. But you hire an architect, he's going to build walls. I mean, I think that was a fundamental mistake in the first place. This was supposed to be a park, not a structure. And it seems to me that this is an opportunity to demonstrate exactly your approach, Dan, which is how to do more with less, and to under the current circumstances, both because there's not enough money and maybe there aren't enough people to fill it, but I bet you could fill it, and you could do it with very simple means for very limited funds, and get back to the idea that park designs are not subject, I don't believe, to the same kind of stylistic swings that the buildings are over time. There are changes in landscape design, but I think the problem has been in landscape architecture that it has become so high concept and high design, but the fundamentals of our connection to nature, grass and trees, to the street, water, tree, sunlight, shade, is so fundamental that when we start messing with it on aesthetic grounds too much, we miss the basics, and we just miss the simplest basic things in Pershing Square. Maybe this is an opportunity to do it simply and for very little money.
Yeah, I would argue that we're, when we talk about funding, we're missing the boat a little bit, because what we really should be thinking about is not dollars but resources. And when you think about a park as a natural resource and you think about what it takes to operate it, it may not be that, you know, it's, I'll take the $298 chairs versus the $40 wooden ones. But when you think about trees and you think about all these things, there's Tree People, there's Northeast Trees, there's, you know, all these organizations that have lots of trees, and we have a great population that if we can really energize them to help us out, to be the friends of Pershing Square or Paws Park, when we start thinking about resource instead of funding, I think we change the conversation and we change the paradigm through which we're looking at the parks themselves. And so I'd say let's look at the resources we have and let's shift our conversation from the funding somewhat, because I think we have the context to make all of it work.
I think the I think it's just about at 8:30. I think clearly there are some major political and infrastructural and financial obstacles here, but I think if there's one kind of consensus that's come out of this discussion, which I think is a really encouraging step forward in thinking about the future of Pershing Square, is there seems to be real agreement that from a design point of view, this is probably a little easier than we've made it out to be over the years, and that if we can figure out a way to maybe dismantle or undo some of what's there, the solution then going forward can be relatively straightforward and maybe relatively inexpensive. Who knows? So with that, please join me in thanking the panelists for a terrific discussion. Thank you thank you all for coming, and thanks again to Aloud and to CalArts and Red Cat for organizing these discussions.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.